But basically, this part of Colorado has long had a personal relationship with nuclear weapons of mass destruction because of the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. This bomb factory, as Dr. Robbins mentioned, is located 16 miles northwest of Denver and 8 miles south of Boulder. This facility was made up of about 800 buildings situated in the middle of a site 10 square miles in size. Rocky Flats was a key facility in the U.S. nuclear weapons production complex. It was established in 1951 to basically build the successors to the Nagasaki and Trinity bombs. At Nagasaki, one bomb created a blast equivalent of 22,000 tons of TNT and killed an estimated 70,000 people initially and more later from radiation poisoning. Without a serious public debate, and following the detonation of an atomic bomb by the Soviet Union in 1949, the federal government decided that nuclear instruments of mass destruction were weapons and needed for the country's national security. Officials expanded the U.S. nuclear complex in the early 1950s. The announcement of Rocky Flats came just 2 months after the first nuclear bomb test in Nevada in January 1951. Plutonium was produced in nuclear reactors at Hanford in Washington State and at Savannah River in South Carolina and shipped to Colorado. Some of the plutonium at Hanford was created in a reactor also used to produce electricity. I'll come back to that later. In October 1952, the same year Rocky Flats went into full operation, the United States successfully tested a hydrogen bomb with an explosive power on the order of 1,000 times larger than the Hiroshima or Nagasaki bombs. Subsequently, the plutonium bombs manufactured at Rocky Flats were primarily used as bomb cores or pits to detonate or trigger hydrogen bombs. To this day, despite my best efforts, local papers still sometimes refer to Rocky Flats as a nuclear trigger factory. What a marvelous euphemism, a way to conceal the reality about a plant that built weapons of mass destruction. The solid plutonium buttons were machined at Rocky Flats into hollow shells about the size of oblong softballs. The cutting and grinding created a lot of waste in flakes and chips. All of this manufacturing was conducted inside stainless steel glove boxes aimed at protecting workers from the dangerous alpha particles emitted by plutonium-239. In processing plutonium, Rocky Flats was essentially a chemical factory. It created a tremendous amount of waste from chemicals such as carbon tetrachloride mixed with plutonium residue. This waste was buried or stored outside in barrels, subject to the extreme weather changes in Colorado, below freezing winters and blazing hot summers. The barrels leaked and high winds sent much of the plutonium off the site into nearby communities. Plutonium is a rather strange element, dangerous in both large and small quantities. In many forms, it's pyrophoric. It combusts spontaneously in air. Previously classified government documents recount that hundreds of fires occurred in plant production lines. 2 years before the first large Rocky Flats fire in 1957, the Atomic Energy Commission issued 4 guidelines for preventing plutonium fires. Its report concluded, quote, expect a fire. A nearly catastrophic fire occurred on Mother's Day, May 11, 1969. A fire in a manufacturing building holding 7,641 pounds of plutonium erupted in a glove box system. The fire was fanned by the building's exhaust system. That system was shut down only after a fire truck accidentally backed into a utility pole. If the fire had been a little bigger, according to a top AEC official, quote, hundreds of square miles would have been contaminated. The 1969 fire finally got the media and public's attention. Now I'll turn this over to my colleague, Bill Marin.
And I would say that it was probably more important more significant that Rocky Flats was located only 8 miles from Boulder, which was characterized 2 years ago by the New York Times as 25 square miles surrounded by reality. 1978 became known as the year of disobedience. That was in honor of Tony leaving the state, I suppose. And one of these protests actually became a blockade. Starting in 1980, every Sunday, there was a demonstration at the western entrance to Rocky Flats. Perhaps the most dramatic was the encirclement of Rocky Flats by 15,000 protesters composed primarily of peace activists and environmentalists, but together they were a big group. In 1982, the Federal Emergency Management Agency held a public hearing on the civil defense proposal entitled Denver Metro Crisis Relocation Plan. Well, 1,200 people attended, and the Boulder County commissioners unanimously rejected this plan. They concluded that the funds could be better spent on a booklet with the theme, "The only way for us as a community and as a nation to survive is to prevent nuclear war." And so this Boulder County Nuclear Education Booklet was published by the Boulder County Commissioners and distributed by the Boulder Council of Churches and Synagogues. I suppose that crosses the line there a little. But two quotes from this booklet are worth sharing with you. Thomas Jefferson made the comment, "The care of human life and happiness and not their destruction is the first and only legitimate role and object for good government." And then the second quote is from Leonard Brezhnev in the early 80s, in which he was quoted as saying, "Military superiority loses its meaning with the present enormous stockpiles of nuclear weapons." Well, in August 6, 1985, the 40th anniversary of nuclear testing and nuclear bombing of Hiroshima, Boulder's mayor proclaimed a resolution to end all nuclear weapon explosions. Really, a high watermark in organized citizen action was reached very soon thereafter when 60% of the electorate in the city of Boulder directed the city council to declare Boulder a nuclear-free zone. Thus, the city council passed Ordinance 5002 in 1986. When it was discovered that the issue of transportation of nuclear material could not be accomplished by city ordinance alone, the city worked with the National League of Cities to address this issue. In July of 1986, 3 months after the Chernobyl accident, the DOE announced that it had reached an agreement in principle with Colorado and the Environmental Protection Agency, which finally had been given the right to supervise cleanup at Rocky Flats and not the Department of Energy, sort of like the fox guarding the chicken coop. But it was given the authority to resolve the issues involving hazardous waste. Yet DOE still believed that whatever dangers existed at Rocky Flats, they were overshadowed by the conviction that nuclear weapons were vital to the nation's defense. An internal DOE memo uncovered later, written during this period, acknowledged that the agreement in principle had diverted attention away to just how really, really bad the site was. With the help of whistleblowers, the FBI raided the site in June of 1989. Nuclear weapons production was permanently halted at the plant finally in 1992. Cleanup began and was completed in 2005 at the cost of $7 billion. And this is the picture of some of the cleanup operations as it was taking place. And this is what Rocky Flats looks like today, being cleaned up. In 2006, the Rocky Mountain Stewardship Council was created to monitor developments at Rocky Flats, including the completion and opening of the National Wildlife Refuge. The biggest bone of contention currently is whether the refuge area is really clean enough to allow the public access to the refuge or development to occur around Rocky Flats. At this very moment, this Stewardship Council is meeting today to consider whether a planned residential and commercial development along the southern boundary of Rocky Flats should be allowed. In 2004, the Boulder mayor attended the annual U.S. Conference of Mayors and signed a resolution adopted by the conference calling for nuclear nonproliferation. And this resolution cited the Mayors for Peace and its vision of 2020, which targets 2020, the 75th anniversary of bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as the date for reducing nuclear weapon stockpiles to zero. In late 2008, my wife and I visited Hiroshima and attended the museum. And anyone going to Japan from the United States must go to Hiroshima. It's only a four-hour trip on the fast train from Tokyo. And through some Japanese friends, we met with the president of the Hiroshima Peace Culture Foundation. He informed us about the Mayors for Peace initiative, which at the time had over 3,000 members from around the world. So when we learned that Denver was the only city in Colorado which had become a member, we volunteered to approach the city of Boulder about joining. And we did that, and in November of 2009, the Boulder City Council voted unanimously for Boulder, that's pretty amazing, to become members of the Mayors for Peace. And that's our certificate. At this time, the city of Boulder is one of the member cities in the United States, 160 of them, which includes Salt Lake City, Houston, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, and the college towns of Chapel Hill, Berkeley, and Oberlin. As of September 2010, had increased to 4,144 member cities throughout the world. And here you can see the trajectory of the number of cities from beginning with Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1982 to the current 4,144. And this, of course, was the emphasis on the momentum created by PSR and others for the eradication of nuclear weapons worldwide by 2020. So at this point, I mentioned 160 in the United States, but there were actually, in Germany, there were 367 cities. And that pales in significance to the over 700 in Japan that have signed on as Mayors for Peace.
So we forgot to tell you, this is a tag team that has two parts. I'm just going to close up real quickly. The largest legacy of Rocky Flats is the fact that the weapons, the plutonium bombs that were made there, are in the U.S. arsenal, more than 9,000 weapons. And Rocky Flats created most of the plutonium bombs at the core of the approximately 70,000 nuclear weapons produced by the United States. This slide just shows that there are 9 countries currently with nuclear weapons. The I was delighted that Dr. Gould mentioned the connection, the tight connection between nuclear weapons and nuclear power. That's something that gets often ignored. And, you know, he showed a different slide of what's called the nuclear fuel cycle. It's the cradle-to-grave process. And, you know, as many of you know, nuclear power is being promoted as a solution to the very real problem of human-induced climate change. The problem is that the crossover points between nuclear power production and nuclear weapons production in the fuel cycle are usually ignored. And those crossover points come during uranium enrichment, where the uranium, the enrichment is continued beyond the 4% necessary for a nuclear power plant to the 90% necessary for a bomb. In order to get to the 4% of uranium-235, the fissile material in uranium, about 70% of the energy used in order to get all the way to 90% has already been expended. So it's fairly quick, and that's the issue of Iran. The reprocessing of plutonium, every nuclear power plant creates plutonium. The question is whether or not it's reprocessed. If it's reprocessed, it can be made into plutonium bombs. This is not something for, you know, only the most sophisticated countries. That's how North Korea achieved its nuclear arsenal, now estimated to be about 10 nuclear weapons. So this is the current nuclear power debate. You know, as you hear the debate and as you hear about abolition, you know, think too about nuclear power and don't forget, you know, the connections there. There are other reasons, of course, you know, why people are opposed to nuclear power, the accidents that shut down the Indian Point reactor and the Vermont reactor today are among them, as well as today is also the day that the reprocessed nuclear waste from France arrived in Germany after much protest, including 20,000 police officers, you know, called out at a cost of $70 million, I believe, was the number I saw. So thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. We do have time for a couple of questions. Are there questions?
Yeah, this is a question about depleted uranium. And the depleted uranium is part of the fuel cycle. Can I go back on this? Depleted uranium comes in the process when uranium is enriched. And depleted, you know, simply means that there is less uranium-235 in that uranium than there was, you know, before it was processed. It has been, you know, a very big issue. Dr. Gould may have other sources. The Federation of American Scientists, you know, has a pretty good website to look at for depleted uranium. Frank von Hippel and Steve Fetter are two physicists who've written about depleted uranium extensively, but it continues to be a controversial subject because uranium is very hard. So depleted uranium, you know, can be used for projectiles to penetrate tanks.
Makes good bullets,
yes.
Time for one more question. Are there any? Yes, right over here, please.
Does your concern about the reaction also apply to heavy water reactors or just light water reactors?
Well, there's even more concern with heavy water reactors because heavy water reactors produce plutonium, you know, as a natural product. So they're of much greater concern. The light water reactors, you know, are the ones in common use that requires reprocessing. But heavy water reactors, you can use natural uranium. You don't have to process. You know, so there isn't the enrichment problem because you're not enriching the uranium, but there is the plutonium production problem at the back end of the cycle.
Thank you very much.